Today is Friday, April 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the edited Mueller report is released, and despite the president's claims he is not exonerated.
The special counsel made clear that he did not exonerate the president, and the responsibility now falls to Congress to hold the president accountable for his actions.
Christians celebrate Easter Sunday as Jews observe Passover this weekend. Also ahead, after a brief illness, Stevie Nicks is back on stage with Fleetwood Mac. It's all on today's International Edition. Special Counsel Robert Mueller investigated 11 instances in which he suspected that President Trump had obstructed justice by trying to thwart his investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. But ultimately, he couldn't prove the president's intent to break the law. The 448-page report released on Thursday concludes there's no evidence that Trump or his campaign aides coordinated with the Russians to interfere on behalf of Trump's presidential election campaign against Hillary Clinton. However, the report cites numerous efforts by an angst-ridden Trump to derail or impede the federal probe. And eager to get in the last word ahead of the public release of the report, Attorney General William Barr Thursday laid out in advance what he said was the bottom line: no collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian government hackers.
But the special counsel found no evidence that any American, including anyone associated with the Trump campaign, conspired or coordinated with the Russian government or the IRA in this illegal scheme.
House Judiciary Chair Gerald Nadler, after receiving the report, said it contradicts much of Barr's defense of Trump.
I have formally requested that Special Counsel Mueller testify before the House Judiciary Committee as soon as possible so we can get some answers to these critical questions, because we clearly can't believe what Attorney General Barr tells us.
Joining us now to talk more about all of it in this two-part interview is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, let's first start with the way this report was rolled out after a very long wait. It has taken 20-some days to actually see it, for Congress and the American public to see it, largely due to how the Trump-appointed Attorney General of the United States has handled this situation, with the culmination of a news conference in the morning before actually releasing the report.
It's extraordinary when you have an Attorney General who's purposely controlling, describing, manipulating, if you want to go that far, exactly what it was that the president wants to say and how he says it, and how he prepares the landscape for the report itself. It wasn't just the four-page memorandum of Mueller's conclusions, but his conclusion. And then ultimately, a press conference before to describe, using the president's language, exactly what he wanted to describe.
It certainly did seem like he said no collusion, which is pretty much Trump's standard line, a number of times. But my understanding is that the report never mentioned the word collusion.
Actually, it goes further than that. The report specifically says, we are not looking at the question of collusion, because collusion is not a legal standard. It is not a crime. That's not what we're looking at. We are looking at something called conspiracy, and whether or not Trump and the team around Trump conspired with the Russians. So the fact that Attorney General Barr was simply parroting the president is really equally astounding and says something even a bit more troubling about it.
So let's get to how this all came about. This two-year investigation, it became very clear from the intelligence community that Russia interfered with the election to try to elect Donald Trump. And apparently it came to light that there was a lot of evidence that potentially might have led to the Trump campaign being sort of a willing participant in allowing that to continue, or allowing the help to continue. Just take us through where we are and where we've come.
23 months, thousands of subpoenas, hundreds of warrants, work with more than a dozen foreign governments trying to get all of the information that they could in this case, with thousands and thousands of hours of work trying to put all this together. And in the end, Mueller and his team focused in on two areas: the question of conspiracy, whether or not Trump and his team conspired with the Russians, and obstruction of justice, whether or not they tried to essentially stop the investigation. And so after 2 years and all of that effort, it really came down to those two areas, and that was the focus of this entire investigation.
And all along, the president has been very unhappy about this investigation, and from all indications from the Mueller report that we can see, he certainly did want to have it ended.
It's very clear that the president, from the very beginning, wanted this to stop. In fact, as he said, his own language, which we can't repeat, he was effed. You can follow the logical conclusion of that. Those were his words.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clear that the president wanted to stop this investigation. He attacked anybody and everybody tied to it. And in fact, it appears, based upon the report itself, that the president tried to stop the investigation itself, which goes to the obstruction piece. But in fact, and this is astounding to me, it's his own people who ignored him, but for their deciding to stop the president themselves, it's very possible that obstruction would have stuck.
There were many points in this very long conclusion, but since we first brought up the attorney general and his conclusions that he said he disagreed with Mueller on things, particularly when it comes to obstruction, he seems to have done his best to try to exonerate the president, which the special counsel in the report, as far as I can see, specifically says it does not exonerate him, nor does it conclude that he committed a crime. But there was a line in there that would sort of indicate that he really meant for Congress to make that decision. Is that what you took away from it?
Absolutely. I think when we look at the language of the report itself and you compare that to what Attorney General Barr said, that in itself is disturbing, because what Barr said simply did not reflect what the report said. He said the president was totally exonerated. In fact, the report said just the opposite when it came to the obstruction charge. The report said that they could not exonerate the president. And even further in the report, it said this, and I quote, "The conclusion that Congress may apply the obstruction law to the president's corrupt exercise of the powers of the office accords with a constitutional system of checks and balances and the principle that no person is above the law." That statement right there tells me that what Bob Mueller was trying to say is that this question of obstruction is something that doesn't go to the Attorney General. It doesn't even go to Bob Mueller.
Mm-hmm.
It goes to Congress.
Right. Unlike the Attorney General, who is under the opinion that the president can't be convicted of anything, any crime.
Actually, if you think about what the Attorney General was trying to argue, and you think about what Bob Mueller was actually saying, his response was, if you accept the standard that justice is not going to indict a sitting president, then what we should do is we should defer on that question, put it in the hands of Congress to make the decision. And based upon that, that appears to be an invitation to impeach, or at least consider the issue. And if you decide that the behavior rose to the level, then Congress should make the consideration of impeaching this president.
All right. We will be right back with part two of our interview with criminal defense attorney Jack Rice on the Mueller report and what it actually reveals.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Well, we now continue with part two of our interview with criminal attorney, defense attorney Jack Rice on the Mueller report. Well, we talked about obstruction of justice and the special counsel's inability to make a conclusive decision on that, partly because the office learned that some individuals they interviewed or investigated associated with the Trump campaign destroyed evidence, deleted relevant communications. That would obviously make it more difficult, but I would think that would also be a crime.
It would be a lot of things. First of all, the president wouldn't sit down with Bob Mueller and his team. So you have no idea what was in the head of the president, and obstruction certainly goes to your mens rea, what you're thinking about, how you're approaching this. The president would not sit down. Number two, there were six people indicted or convicted so far just surrounding the president. We also know that multiples of them lied to the special investigator about this issue, and there was destruction of evidence. Based upon all of those issues, it was very difficult for Bob Mueller and his team to make that determination. They even said in the report themselves that a more thorough investigation from the Bureau, from the FBI, may actually ferret that information out, because this investigation had narrow parameters. And one thing is very clear, Bob Mueller is a lawyer's lawyer. This is a guy who is not going to go any further than he's supposed to, but he's not going to go any less than he's required. He'll do exactly what he's supposed to do and no more. This guy is a pro.
Right. So in other words, there may have been quite a bit of evidence to point in the direction of obstruction, but not enough to actually go all the way to convict. And because a president, according to the rules, cannot be indicted, then it wouldn't have gone anywhere. They wouldn't have been able to really follow through on it anyway. Is that the gist of it?
Maybe, but actually, it's even more than that. There's a possibility there may be more information that's out there that the Bureau could get their hands on if they had time to look at it and make that determination, let alone all of the other investigations that are out there. So think about the Southern District of New York. There's an investigation going on by the New York Attorney General. That's a separate investigation that's going on. There are several others that are going on in Congress as well. And those are issues that should ferret out the truth and exactly what all of that means.
Another really big, important part of this whole thing, the overwhelming evidence of how deep Russia was into the U.S. system of democracy, the U.S. election system.
That is maybe the most important and astounding piece of this entire investigation, and I think is being missed by a lot of people. The president from the beginning tried to deny this, but in fact, it's been proven, and this makes me feel good from the perspective of a former intelligence operative. It was the intelligence community that came back and said it was the Russians. This is what they were trying to do. And specifically, in this case, the Russians wanted Donald Trump to be president of the United States. It's what they wanted because they thought they would get the kinds of answers and the kind of political decisions that a Donald Trump would put in place once he was in the White House. And the fact that they went as deep as they did to try to make this happen was a big part of this report, because it may make a difference in terms of how the intelligence community and the United States government in general addresses this issue in the future.
The problem, though, lies therein that the president apparently feels, and I believe this might have even been in the report, that if he acknowledges that Russia interfered, it would make his presidency illegitimate. To some degree, it seems like that would be a relevant question to ask if the Russians really wanted him elected, and his campaign, whether it helped them or not, certainly didn't stop it.
They didn't. If we look at what the Russians did, they made effort after effort, offer after offer to the Trump team. But one of the problems, and this is one of the really difficult and frustrating things as I read this report, not once did members of the Trump team or Donald Trump himself pick up the phone and call the FBI, call Justice Department and say, hey, we just had somebody from the Russian embassy, a Russian intelligence. We think you need to take a look at it. They never did that. Not one time.
How concerned should we be about the next election and Russian interference, which we are hearing is already happening?
Well, we should be concerned. If you look at where we are right now and where this attorney general is on this, and honestly, where the entire administration is, they want to do one thing. They want to say total vindication. Don't read the report. Don't look at the report. Don't look at the administration's behavior. Don't look at the behavior of the election campaign itself and what the Trump team did or didn't do or should have done and didn't bother to do. Rather, just remember complete vindication, move on. But the problem is it ignores all of the failures and all of the really, really poor decisions that were made by the Donald Trump team. And those issues continue.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. North Korea says Secretary of State Mike Pompeo isn't welcome at nuclear negotiations. Protesters converge on Sudan's defense ministry to demand civilian rule. Americans' energy use surges despite climate change concerns. And a new study finds authoritarian leaders fuel hatred toward journalists worldwide. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The capital of Somalia, Mogadishu, has for more than a decade struggled against Islamist al-Shabaab militants. Somali authorities say in March attacks tripled with 15 bombings in just a week's time. Authorities responded with additional checkpoints, improving security but making work difficult for the city's thousands of tuk-tuk taxi drivers. Reporter Mohammed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
20-year-old driver Mohammed Deq checks his tuk-tuk taxi every morning before setting off to work. He's looking for a bomb. Al-Shabaab militants are known for sabotage, and their average monthly attacks in Mogadishu have tripled since March. Somalia's capital has thousands of tuk-tuk drivers, and they are often victims.
The tuk-tuk drivers have been badly affected by both explosions and roadblocks in Mogadishu. Meanwhile, the government says that it will tighten security, but every time it announces so, security deteriorates. For instance, six of my fellow tuk-tuk drivers were killed as a result of explosions that took place in Mogadishu.
The government's inability to provide security is to blame, say critics like Somali lawmaker and former security minister Abdirizaq Umar.
15 explosions in 1 week, and the numbers are going up and up. It's not slowing down. And one of the reasons why there's such an escalation is because the government hasn't had a policy or a strategy to counter al-Shabaab insurgents.
Somali authorities dispute the idea that they are not working hard to secure the capital and defeat al-Shabaab. To stop the surge in attacks, they increased patrols and set up more checkpoints.
We work both day and night. We want to connect between the police and community in order for them to be able to work together on security issues.
Somali security seized a large store of weapons earlier this month. They said it was al-Shabaab's.
The seized weapons include explosive belts, ammunition bombs, materials to make homemade explosives, and both heavy and light large weapons.
But al-Shabaab militants are not the only ones responsible for civilian deaths. At least five people were killed in Mogadishu Saturday in violent protests by drivers angry over security forces this month, killing a tuk-tuk driver. While the circumstances of the shooting are unclear, over the last 3 years, security forces have killed more than 20 tuk-tuk drivers. But for drivers like Deq, navigating the threats of al-Shabaab and rash security is still the best option to earn a living in Somalia. Mohammed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu.
Noi non siamo distributori di olio in bottiglia.
Ahead of the sacred Christian holiday of Easter Sunday, Pope Francis told clergy they are not distributors of bottled oil, but they anoint by distributing ourselves, distributing our vocation and our heart. And this weekend also marks the two-day Jewish holiday of Passover. Joining us to understand more about their observance is Rabbi Terry Buchman, author of the upcoming book Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. Thank you for being with us. First, tell us a little bit about what Passover is all about.
Passover has multiple meanings, and some of them are historic and some of them are spiritual. But the primary theme of Passover is liberation. You know, we have the historic liberation from slavery. And then the second half of the Seder, which most people fall asleep on, is about the ultimate liberation or redemption of all humankind, what some people call the messianic time. So it's about liberation.
And all of the traditions behind it, including the Seder, really have everything to do with freedom.
It's freedom from slavery. Some of it has to do with the coming of spring and the rebirth and the hopefulness that springtime brings, because remember, these were agricultural people, so it was a time of planting and new life. We survived the winter, and here we are, so there's those themes as well.
How does all this relate to the situation in the Middle East with Israel and the Palestinians and the ongoing, seemingly endless effort for peace in light of everything that is happening, including the re-election of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, I think that if we're going to take the SEDA personally, which we are really commanded to do, that it's not something that happened to them, but it's happening to us as well, then if we're going to celebrate our liberation, our freedom, then we have to look at the plight of the Palestinians who are not free. Whether you want to use the term occupied or not, the truth is they do not have freedom. And we in the Jewish community are fond of saying never again when it comes to the Holocaust. But never again is not just about us. It's about genocide should never happen against any people, and that we should be mindful of that, and that if people are threatened, we have to take a stand for them. And so the same thing is true here. We cannot celebrate our own liberation while we stand idly by. And sadly, the Netanyahu government has moved further right and is in bed with parties that really do not want to see the Palestinians even as human beings who have their own story of slavery and suffering. That's part of their narrative, too. We have to hear it.
How does anyone seeking to resolve the situation find that balance?
Well, balance begins by being willing to listen to the other and to see the other as my brother or sister. If I declassify or dehumanize them, then I won't hear. So peace between Palestinians and Israelis are not going to happen in one fell swoop. It's going to happen in stages. But it begins by the humanization of the other and listening to their story, not just telling our own. God gave us one mouth and two ears for a purpose. And unfortunately, there's not enough listening. There's a lot of demonizing that goes on both sides. That has to stop.
And you have a new book coming out in May called Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. How does that tie into all of this that we are talking about?
Well, you know, that's a lot of us are kind of sad or pessimistic right now. But my new book is about really showing a way that we can thrive. And thriving, or thrival, as I sometimes refer to it, the made-up word, is a really hopeful look at the future. And there's a whole chapter about Israel as well and how way out of its current morass, so that not only Israelis can thrive, but the Palestinians and all of us. And the Jewish community itself here in America and abroad, we like to focus on the negative news. But there's lots of opportunity out there. And my book is about taking advantage of those opportunities and for all of us human beings to thrive. And not just as a Jewish community, but my thriving, my neighbors thriving, we can all thrive.
All right, Rabbi Terry Buchman, author of the upcoming book, Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, as we head into the holiday weekend, many Americans will be heading to the movies, and there are a variety of options to choose from. Joining us to get some ideas is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, you're starting with a film that's a true story that's actually almost hard to believe.
It is a true story, and I've talked to a lot of the cast. I've done some interviews with them, and they said before they accepted the role, they looked into it, too, to make sure that, you know, things that weren't too fantastical or, you know, stuff that really didn't happen, and they did. So, and it's based on this inspirational true story of a mother and her love for her son, Joy Smith, and her adopted son, John, falls through an icy Missouri lake. He fell through the ice, and he was pronounced dead for 45 minutes, and then she prayed, and instantly, when she asked for it, he came back. It's about his recovery in the face of adversity, you know, about family coming together and the community. And it's from producer Devon Franklin, who did Miracles from Heaven and The Star. He's been a real incredible producer for these faith-based films. We always get these kind of films around Easter time, you know, coming out, you know, next week. And so Breakthrough is really one of the most popular stories, doing some research on it. And it is, you know, it's just those things you can't explain. And it also stars Chrissy Metz, you know, from This Is Us, the very popular ABC series. She plays Joy Smith. And this woman just has an amazing range. I noticed in real life she can sing and she does a little comedy, but she does this emotional performance in this movie that'll just have you in tears. And Topher Grace, who last year we saw in Black Klansman playing, you know, David Duke, the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, he's playing Pastor Jason Noble, seeing him in a totally different light. And of course, Brian Smith, the character is played by Josh Lucas, who also is just one of our great character actors out there too, playing the father. So this is something from a major studio. It's from Walt Disney, and distributed Walt Disney and 20th Century Fox. And these films do very, very well because people are looking for not only a faith-based movie, but it's also something you can go to about inspiration, about hope, and about miracles, and however you've defined that in your life. It's really a great family film and an inspirational story. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I did.
Sounds beautiful. All right. Well, we've also got...
The Curse of La Llorona translates the Weeping Woman, and it's from a Mexican urban legend. And it's about a woman that, over 150 years ago, she caught her husband with another woman who was much younger and more beautiful. So to get back at him, she drowned her children in the river. And then she just became so guilty about that, she drowned herself. But now the curse is she's wandering the earth looking for her children's souls. But if she comes across your children, if you hear her weeping, then she's going to steal your children. I know how creepy this is. It sounds like it's right out of a Grimm's fairy tale. And so this is the sixth entry in the Conjuring universe. So if you know those films, The Conjuring, this is from producer James Wan. And Linda Cardellini plays a social worker who stumbles across the weeping woman and her family is threatened. And Raymond Cruz, who's this great character actor that we've seen for many, many years, he plays almost like kind of like an exorcist to help keep the weeping woman away from the family. Directed by Michael Chavez, this is his first time directing, and it's really creepy. This has got all the jumps, it's got all the scares, and what's really cool about it is it's not a horror film, it's more of a ghost story. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, like, for the first time, twice during the movie when I saw it, I had chills up my spine. I mean, you don't even feel that like somebody took their finger and goes up your spine, and I haven't had that in a long time. So this is really a creepy film, nothing too groundbreaking, we've seen it before, but it's just the mood and you just get into it. And the kids who play in this movie, the emotion and the acting ability they have is unbelievable, because you know they're acting, doing stuff over and over, but they have to convince you that they're frightened and you're screaming along with them. So I think this is going to be a big hit, something you want to see, a really creepy ghost story. Now The Curse of La Llorona is one to check out.
All right, I guess some people like to go to the movies and get scared. Other people avoid that at all costs.
Well, you can see a God-fearing miracle or a weeping woman stealing children's soul. It's right. Something for everyone this weekend, this Easter.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard. Find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Fleetwood Mac has announced rescheduled dates for its North America tour that were postponed earlier this month because singer Stevie Nicks had the flu. The Grammy-winning band set to play Boston and a number of Canadian cities and then back to Philadelphia in November. The band says previously held tickets will be honored and new ones go on sale also. Fleetwood Mac tour features the original band members Mick Fleetwood, John McVie, Stevie Nicks, and Christine McVie, along with newcomers Mike Campbell and Neil Finn. Stevie Nicks, by the way, recently inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That I You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. The gypsy.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.